The next need that all people have is for leisure. Once a person is safe, secure, and comfortable, he or she wants to take it easy, to take time off, and to relax. People want to take evenings, weekends, and summer vacations off. Leisure time activities are trillion-dollar industries in affluent societies, in the forms of vacations, travel, cruise lines, visits to Disneyland, national monuments, national parks, and large cities. Leisure time activities embrace golf, going to restaurants, flying, sailing, hiking, camping, having friends over for dinner, and socializing. In advanced societies where the basic needs of safety, security, and comfort are largely met for the majority of the population, leisure time activities become the central preoccupation for most people. In any workplace, the main subject of discussion is likely to be conversation about what people are going to do after work, on the weekends, and on their vacations. The obsession with watching sporting activities is a fulfillment of the desire for leisure. As you move up the scale of needs, once leisure needs are satisfied, the individual seeks love. Maslow referred to this as an esteem need, but it is much more than that. Psychologists say that everything we do in life is to either get love or to compensate for lack of love. Most psychological problems in adulthood and even in childhood can be traced back to love withheld. Children need love like roses need rain. Even adults, with all their excuses, are love-tropic. We gravitate toward and are most influenced by the people that we love and who love us. We never feel whole or complete until we are in a satisfactory love relationship with another person. It has been said that men give love to get sex and women give sex to get love. There's some truth to this. Recent psychological studies show that when a man is in love with a woman, he is willing to pay substantially more for things that he thinks will please her than he ever would if he were not in a romantic state of mind. Here's an important point. Emotions distort valuations. When a person experiences a need intensely, his or her ability to correctly value the cost of satisfying that need often goes out the window. Intense emotion of any kind, love or hate, desire or lust, fear or loathing, can cause a great disconnect between the true value of an item and the item itself. Intense emotion causes distorted thinking and irrational behaviors of all kinds. For example, the manufacturer's list price on a new red sports car may be $30,000. But the cars are sold out and backordered for several months. There's only one left. A person who intensely desires that particular car will quite commonly pay a premium of $5,000 or $10,000 to get it if he can get it right now. A starving person may pay $50 for a hamburger. A person dying of thirst in the desert may pay $100 for a glass of water. A man who is passionately in love with a woman may pay any price to buy her things and may even steal the money. Emotions distort valuations, and sometimes dramatically. This phenomenon explains many of the otherwise unexplainable behaviors of so many people. Once a person has satisfied his needs in the areas of safety, security, comfort, leisure, and love, the next motivator that arises and drives behavior is the need for respect. As I mentioned before, earning and keeping the respect of others whose opinions we value is a powerful motivator for us. Author William Manchester, writing about his experiences in World War II in the Pacific, noted that people fought and died in terrible conditions rather than running away because they did not want to lose the respect of the men on either side of them. One element of vanity is our idea of how we are thought about and talked about by others. If the people we most respect are men and women of great character and integrity, our desire to live up to their standards will serve as an internal guide to our behaviors, causing us to strive to be the best we can be. The dark side of the need for the respect of others is often seen in the inner cities, where fatherless boys look up to the Cadillac-driving, money-flashing pimp or drug dealer. They strive to earn his respect by embracing his attitude and mimicking his behaviors. The most powerful influence you can have on the people who look up to you is to be a role model for them. You should strive to talk and behave in such a way that if other people, especially your children and friends, were to behave the same way, they would act and feel better, and their lives would be improved. The seventh need that each person has, once the first six needs have been satisfied to an acceptable level, is the need for fulfillment. Each person, deep inside, has an intense desire to fulfill his or her potential as a human being. Some experts say that all unhappiness is rooted in a feeling of frustrated potential. It is only when you feel that you are enjoying complete self-expression, that you are living the very best life you can live, and achieving the very most of which you are capable, it is only then that you feel truly happy. Maslow found that self-actualizing people were the happiest and most fulfilled of all people. Psychologist Carl Rogers referred to this type of individual as the FFP, the fully functioning person, and suggested that this was the height of personal development to which one could aspire. When we combine these two sides of the coin of human personality, we see that each person is lazy, greedy, selfish, ambitious, vain, ignorant, and impatient. At the same time, each person strives throughout their lives to fulfill their needs to get as much safety, security, comfort, leisure, love, respect, and fulfillment as possible, the fastest and easiest way he can. It's been said that money may not be the most important thing, but it's way up there with oxygen. The fastest and easiest way to get the things you want as quickly as possible is almost always to have enough money to be able to buy them, whatever they cost. For this reason, the desire to acquire money quickly and easily and as much as possible is a major motivator of human behavior. But it is not usually money that people really want. Sometimes I will ask my clients why they want to acquire a lot of money. After thinking about their answer for a couple of minutes, they finally conclude that what they want more than anything else is freedom. In reality, they see money as a means to achieving the freedom they really desire. They define freedom as having enough money so that they can get everything they want. They feel that having enough money will enable them to be completely free from worry about safety, security, comfort, leisure, love, respect, and fulfillment. They see having lots of money as the fastest way to the good life. In our Focal Point Advanced Coaching and Mentoring Program, we do an exercise in values clarification. When everyone is seated, we hand out individual checks made out to each person in the amount of $10 million. Of course, the checks are not cashable, but the idea of receiving $10 million cash gives people an opportunity to fantasize about what they really want in their lives. We then have the participants break into groups and discuss what they would do if they suddenly received $10 million. They then report back to the group. We go around the room and write down their answers on a whiteboard or flip chart. Here is the most amazing discovery. Almost everything that our clients would want to do, have, or acquire does not cost any money. When people think of suddenly being financially independent, they immediately think about quality of life issues. As we go around the room, the answers that come back are something like, I would work shorter days and spend more evenings and weekends with my family. I would take a long vacation with my wife. I would join a health club and exercise every day to lose weight and get fit. I would write the book I've always wanted to write. I would get more involved with my church or political party. I would take up painting. I would write poetry. I would reorganize my business and my life, and so on. This is an exercise that you can do as well. Imagine that you receive $10 million cash today. What would you do differently in your life if you had all the money that you could ever need? You may be surprised at the answers that you come up with. This brings us to one of the most important discoveries in all our work on something for nothing and the E factor. It is the desire for power. This is one of the most destructive forces in the world today and always has been. If the fastest and easiest way to get all the things you want is to have all the money you need, it then follows that the fastest and easiest way to get the money you need is to acquire power over people and resources, both in business and at the political level. The urge to power, the need for power, the love of power, the desperate things that people will do to get or to hold on to power explain many of the otherwise unexplainable events taking place in our world today. Power can be defined as the ability to control or influence money, people, and resources. It is ultimately the ability to force people to do what you want them to do, whether or not it is consistent with their own personal desires. Power in its negative form is used to abuse people and take advantage of situations. Because of the E factor, power is initially sought to achieve a result or goal the fastest and easiest way possible. Afterwards, power is sought for its own sake, because of the simple love of power. The fastest and easiest way to get the safety, security, comfort, leisure, love, respect, and fulfillment that a person wants is by acquiring the power, one way or another, that enables him to command those basic needs from others without having to earn them, and with little or no effort on his part. The desire to acquire power is therefore perfectly logical and completely in keeping with the E factor and the desire to get something for nothing. Men and women are physically different in many ways, of course. One of the most important differences involves the level of testosterone that each of them has from infancy onward. Testosterone is the hormone of masculinity that triggers the drive to dominance, power, and status in society. Men with high testosterone levels are more competitive, aggressive, hostile, bolder, more assertive, and more determined to move ahead and succeed. The more they satisfy this testosterone-driven impulse, the faster and easier they achieve the safety, security, comfort, leisure, love, respect, and fulfillment that they and everyone else wants. In the natural order of things, men do much of what they do to please the women who have the greatest influence over them. In the studies of self-made millionaires, most of whom are men, they found that when a man becomes successful and wealthy, his expenditures on himself stay very much the same as they were when he had less money. But his expenditures on his wife and his family increase dramatically. One of the basic satisfactions of being a successful male is to be a good provider for his wife and children. This is a major motivator for most men. Again, in the nature of things, women like men who achieve high levels of power, status, achievement, and dominance. They like men with high levels of confidence and competence. Biologically, such a male is more capable of providing for her and her offspring. He is more likely to provide a higher standard of living for them and thereby assure that her children will survive and thrive. Women, because they are more vulnerable than men, especially during pregnancy and the early years of child raising, are much more concerned about satisfying the basic needs of safety and security than men. Solid, hard-working men who get and keep good jobs and provide well for their families are most capable of satisfying those basic female needs. Nature knows what she is doing. The brains of men and women are different. Both men and women have a right brain and a left brain connected by a mass of tissue called the corpus callosum. One of the differences between men's and women's brains is that women use far more of both parts of their brains. They have more connective tissue between the right brain, which is emotional and intuitive, and the left brain, which is logical and practical. For this reason, women are generally more stable and balanced in their thinking than men. Men, on the other hand, have smaller bundles of connective tissue between the hemispheres of the brain and are more likely to specialize and even go to extremes to either left or right brain activities. There are far more geniuses in physics, mathematics, medicine, music, and even cooking amongst men than amongst women. Most Nobel Prizes are awarded to men who tend to go to extremes in their areas of genius in the production of Nobel Prize-winning work. The natural consequence of this brain structure in men is that they go to extremes in the achievement of money and power as well. Virtually all dictators, despots, and totalitarians throughout history have been men. Money starts off as the motivation for an expedient person to fulfill all his needs for himself and his family. It can soon become an end in itself. Once a person has enough money so that he no longer worries about money, it becomes a form of measurement, a scorecard that he uses to compare himself against others, as in athletic competition. Megalomaniacs and dictators often become obsessed with power to the exclusion of all other considerations. By the same token, many men in business become preoccupied with money to the exclusion of other things, especially their families. Many people in politics begin to live and breathe for political power. Their entire lives become focused on acquiring, keeping, and using it, almost to the exclusion of anything else. As Henry Kissinger once said, power is the ultimate aphrodisiac. The journalist Ambrose Bierce once defined fanaticism as redoubling your efforts after your aim has been forgotten. This often becomes the behavior of people who see their needs either satisfied or threatened, depending upon whether they retain or lose their power or money. they become fanatical about it. According to James Q. Wilson, the noted sociologist, the first requirement of human society is hierarchy. All people throughout the world in all cultures and nations need to know the pecking order of their society. Who is on top? Who is in the middle? Who is on the bottom? And especially, where do I rank in comparison with this other person? When two people meet socially, both men and women, the first thing they do is to size each other up to determine where the other person ranks in the social and economic hierarchy. Once each is clear regarding the ranking of the other, it's no longer an issue. They can then relax, put it aside, and turn to socializing. Sometimes the relative rank order of importance of a person is obvious. He or she may be better dressed or wear more expensive jewelry. A man may wear an expensive Swiss watch. A woman may wear a designer dress or carry a designer purse. Sometimes hierarchy becomes clear in the way people speak or in the way that they are treated by others. In any case, each person continually seeks clues to determine the ranking of the other person in comparison with himself or herself. There are different ways that power is acquired in our society. In business, power is acquired by getting results, by making decisions that lead to incremental gains in revenues and profits. The most powerful people in the business world are those with the best reputations for achieving financial goals in their areas of responsibility. Some years ago, Anthony Jay, in his book Management and Machiavelli, explored the role of playing politics in corporations as the key to getting more power and influence. He concluded that political gamesmanship might enable a person to get ahead in an organization temporarily, but sooner or later, his ability to perform and get results would catch up with him. No matter how far ahead he got, playing politics, or how many times he was promoted, eventually he would be confronted with a demand for measurable performance. If the performance was not there, the chair would be kicked out from under the politician, and he would lose his job. He would subsequently have enormous difficulty starting over somewhere else based on his reputation or non-reputation for getting results. In politics, however, power is acquired by winning votes, separate and apart from any measure of personal accomplishment. Many people who go into politics have failed or done poorly in their previous jobs or professions. But in politics, if they have the right connections, personality, support, and issues to win office, they can eventually ascend to positions of power that most of them have never experienced or even imagined. In the private sector, the ultimate measure is results. Did you do the job or not? This is all that matters. The number one reason that executives, including CEOs of Fortune 500 companies, are demoted or fired is summed up simply as failure to perform. In politics, however, it is never necessary to achieve a result. Political activity is not measurable. If you get elected, get along well with your peers and colleagues, keep your head down and don't make mistakes, you can be successful in politics year after year. When a person develops the ability to achieve measurable financial results in business, he enjoys the safety, security, comfort, leisure, love, respect, and fulfillment that go with that achievement. But in politics, it's different. In politics, you are never secure. Because you have not achieved anything measurable to get elected, you are constantly in danger of losing your political office. Any shift in public opinion or scandal, personal or otherwise, can lead you to losing your seat in the next election. One bad call in your political activities can tip the scales, cost you the election, and throw you back into the working force, where you may not have been doing that well in the first place. Once a person enters into politics, in order to stay in power, he needs more and more money. He must be continually campaigning and petitioning for campaign donations. This becomes his most pressing need, the one need that enables him to fulfill all his other needs, especially for job security. Most people who go into politics are well-meaning. They have good ideas to help the people who elected them. But once they get into office, they immediately become determined to hold on to their positions. The longer they stay in politics, the less employable they become in the private sector. Often, they become desperate to win elections. We'll talk about this later. The only thing that you have to know to understand politics is that everyone is lazy, greedy, ambitious, selfish, vain, ignorant, and impatient, including every person who works in or runs a business or who serves in public office. Each person strives continually to get more and more safety, security, comfort, leisure, love, respect, and fulfillment. In business, the only way that you can satisfy these needs in the long term is by producing measurable results, by doing a good job, satisfying customers, building long-term relationships, and keeping the support of the people around you. In politics, however, there's no need to get any other result except to deliver free money to the people who voted for you. For example, Congress larded various laws with more than 14,000 earmarks, the official word for pork or free money, for constituents in 2004 alone. Politicians are lazy, greedy, ambitious, selfish, vain, ignorant, and impatient people, desperate to hold on to power so that they can continue to satisfy their needs for safety, security, comfort, leisure, love, respect, and fulfillment in any way possible. To achieve this, they must deliver. The expediency factor says that people strive to get the things they want the fastest and easiest way possible, with little concern for the likely consequences of their actions. There may be exceptions to the above, but they haven't yet been found. If you want to understand and accurately interpret what is happening in your world, just expect people to act expediently to get the things they want and need the fastest and easiest way possible, and to get something for nothing whenever they can. Now, let's look at how people driven by human nature, by the E factor, get the things they want. Chapter 3. Simple as ABC. As Dale Carnegie once said, there is only one way to get somebody to do anything, and that is by making the other person want to do it. Now, here's a question. What kind of a world is this if everyone is naturally lazy, greedy, selfish, ambitious, vain, ignorant, and impatient? How can society survive if everyone is driven by the E factor to get more and more of what they want the fastest and easiest way possible, with little or no concern for the consequences of their behavior? At the same time, everyone is motivated by an insatiable desire to achieve safety, security, comfort, leisure, love, respect, and fulfillment, manifested by a never-ending drive to acquire money and power. What then stops the world from devolving into a war of all against all? The answer to this dilemma comes from understanding how people go about getting the things they want. Let's divide the way things are done into three parts. We can call the natural instincts that make people lazy, greedy, ambitious, selfish, vain, ignorant, and impatient, which are summarized in the E factor, driving people toward a never-ending search for something for nothing, as A. We can then call the natural needs or desires of all people for safety, security, comfort, leisure, love, respect, and fulfillment, ultimately manifested in a desire for power and money, as C. These two elements, A and C, are fixed factors. They're hardwired into the human psyche. They are immutable parts of human nature and human motivation. The key question, and the only variable in this equation, is how does one get from A, the way people are, to C, what people want? We can call this interim step, or means, by the letter B. Together, we can construct the ABC formula of human activity. Now, there are only two ways that you can get anything. You can earn it, or get it from someone else who has earned it, or you can take it. There are two ways that you can get someone else to do something. You can force him to do it with threats of penalties and punishment, or you can encourage him to want to do it with promises of rewards and benefits. The only way that you can stop many people from engaging in harmful behaviors in the process of getting the things they want the fastest and easiest way possible is by making the cost or punishment for expedient behaviors so high that they are afraid to do it. To stop people from acting expediently, from seeking their own best interest in destructive or criminal ways, you must make the restraints and constraints so costly and severe that people are forced to either curb their natural instincts or suppress them for fear of punishment. Throughout all of history, dictatorships and tyrannies have been based on forcing people to not act expediently or to act contrary to their natural instincts in satisfying their basic needs. This trampling of people and repressing of their natural desires has been the primary use of power throughout history, right up to the present day. Human beings are, generally speaking, neither bad nor evil. They are merely expedient. But when people engage in expedient behaviors which hurt others to get something for little or nothing, and then justify their behaviors, they gradually lose their moral bearings and can then become very evil indeed. In the England of the 1700s, a new way of organizing society appeared, based on voluntary cooperation rather than compulsion and force. It was called the market system. The seeds for this open market society had been sown starting as early as 1215 with the signing of the Magna Carta, the first bill to protect the rights and property of the nobles against the unlimited power of the king. Over the next 500 years, the divine right of kings was challenged more and more. Parliament and representative government was formed. Laws were written. Rights became codified. Gradually, a system of order based on respect for individual liberty and property emerged. On this foundation of law and respect for private property, the free market emerged. Today and throughout the world, whenever a legal structure protecting personal and property rights is created, a free market emerges spontaneously. Individuals begin to save, invest, work, take risks, produce products and services for others, and prosperity begins to increase and spread. The idea of the free market is simple. It is based on peaceful cooperation rather than compulsion or coercion. In a free market, each person has the right to enter the market and sell his products or personal services for whatever amount other people are willing to pay. All transactions are voluntary. No one is forced to either buy or sell. The only way that expedient people can get the things they want in a market society is by offering products and services to others and making them so attractive that others choose to buy them. A free market is based on cooperation and voluntary exchange. The only reason that one person trades with another in a free market is because he expects to be better off after the trade than he was before the trade. He values what the other has to sell more than the money that he has, or more than anything else he could acquire for the same amount of money. If a person is not satisfied with the products or services offered, or their prices, he is free to refrain from engaging in any trade or exchange at all. In 1776, a Scottish philosopher of morals and ethics, Adam Smith, published a book called The Wealth of Nations, explaining how this market system worked. This was the first economics textbook, showing how people who are inherently lazy, greedy, selfish, ambitious, vain, ignorant, and impatient can come together in a free market, each one motivated by the desires to get safety, security, comfort, leisure, love, respect, and fulfillment, and have no choice but to cooperate in such a way that the best interests of each of them are served. One of the best-known observations from The Wealth of Nations is this. Every individual endeavors to employ his capital so that its produce may be of greatest value. He intends only his own security, only his own gain. By pursuing his own interest, he frequently promotes that of society more effectively than when he really intends to promote it. In reality, the free market is the greatest miracle of social cooperation ever conceived of in human society. Because no one can force anyone to act contrary to their best interest in a free market, everyone must voluntarily cooperate with others if they want to satisfy their own personal needs the fastest and easiest way possible. In the free market, the best rise to the top. Those who are the most skillful at bringing together and producing products and services that people want and are willing to pay for tend to emerge from the competition and become even more successful, satisfying customers in more ways. Since every person who controls money or resources wants to earn the highest and best return on those resources, money and resources naturally gravitate toward those people with a proven ability to put them to work in the very best way possible. Everyone benefits in a free market. As products and services become more complex, specialization of labor develops. Instead of having to produce everything he needs by himself, individuals naturally gravitate toward doing those things for which they have a natural facility, which they can do better, and for which they can earn higher pay and greater rewards. Competition among individuals and businesses to serve even more customers by giving them more of the things they want, faster, better, and cheaper, drives innovation. Competition for the seven common desires forces people to become even more creative in producing even more and better products and services for the market. With no intervention, control, or involvement by government or any other organized body, the actions of free people in free markets assures the very best and most efficient allocation of capital, resources, and labor in the satisfying of customer wants and needs. If the entrepreneur guesses wrong and produces a product or service that he cannot sell at a price that yields a sufficient profit to cover the costs of producing it, the losses fall on the shoulders of the entrepreneur and his investors. If the entrepreneur guesses rightly and brings a product or service to market that customers want in such quantity that he can make a sufficient profit with which he can invest and produce even more products and services, everyone benefits. The opportunity to profit in a free market channels the E factor into continually seeking better and faster ways to serve consumers. This is why profits are the costs of the future. Where there are profits, there are jobs, opportunities, and hope for the future. Where there are no profits, jobs disappear, companies shut down, and resources move into the hands of people who can use them better. The Wealth of Nations, which was published in the same year as the Declaration of Independence, became a bestseller in the American colonies in the following years. The ideas of the free market became the bedrock economic principles upon which the American public was founded. They still dominate today, though they are constantly under attack by people and politicians who either do not understand the miracle of voluntary cooperation in open markets or who deliberately choose to ignore it in the pursuit of power and money. Since people are naturally expedient, in that they are lazy, greedy, selfish, ambitious, vain, ignorant, and impatient, there are always a substantial number of people who do not like the idea of being rewarded on the basis of their ability to serve their fellow man in a way that he wants to be served. They detest the idea of the free market. They want rewards without working. They want rewards that are detached from any merit or any need to satisfy other people. Being human, they want something for nothing. It is the duty and responsibility of politicians and policymakers at all levels to disallow any route to financial success except by serving other people in some way. No one should be allowed to benefit except by being voluntarily compensated by those people because they value that service. Allowing people to profit without contributing to the well-being of others is the great dilemma of our day. It threatens the American dream, which I'll talk about later. In the ABC formula of explaining human behavior, both the A, who people are, and the C, what people want, are fixed. They're immutable factors. The only variable is the B, how they get from one to the other. You could call the B the structure of incentives. The structure of incentives determines how a person gets from A to C, the fastest and easiest way possible. Any variation in the structure of incentives will immediately change the behaviors of a certain number of people. Let's organize the various systems of incentives that are available on a scale of 1 to 10, from the lowest and least productive system of incentives to the highest. A system rated at 10 would be one where the only way to get anything you want would be to either produce it yourself or to cooperate with others to get it with and through them. It would be totally voluntary, based on merit and on the perception by each person that he would be better off as a result of working within this system. This is the pure free market system. At the other end of the scale, a system with a rating of 1 would be a cultural and economic structure where lying, cheating, deceiving, defrauding, stealing, violence, and murder are the fastest and easiest way for people to get the things they want. In criminal societies or organizations, these negative behaviors are the primary ways of acquiring safety, security, comfort, leisure, love, respect, and fulfillment, and especially money and power. The individuals who are the most ruthless and unprincipled in the use of violent means to acquire the things they want inevitably rise to the top, crushing all competition or opposition on the way. You see this in third world tyrannies, drug cartels, and in the aftermath of riots and wars. All groupings of individuals into tribes, societies, and nations can be organized along this scale from 1 to 10. Peaceful, democratic societies, governed by law, cluster at the top of the scale. Despotic, impoverished societies, ruled by force and tyranny, generally cluster at the bottom. Societies displaying a mixture of the two extremes are arranged along the middle of the scale. Human nature, however, is like water. It flows downhill, in and through any crack, crevice, or hole that it can find. Human nature instinctively, impulsively, reflexively drives people to continually strive to get the things they want the fastest and easiest way possible, with little concern for the likely consequences. As soon as there is any way for people to fulfill their desires other than by working and cooperating voluntarily with others, some people, and then more and more, will find that loophole and take advantage of it. In 1240 AD, the philosopher William of Ockham proposed a tool for thinking that became known as Ockham's razor, because it cut quickly and sharply to the core of any argument or controversy. What William of Ockham said was, "In solving any problem or explaining any situation, the simplest solution or explanation is probably the correct one." Socrates said something similar to this in Plato's Dialogues in 390 BC. He said, "The correct explanation for any phenomena or the solution to any problem is usually the one with the fewest parts or steps." In the movie Jerry Maguire, starring Tom Cruise and Cuba Gooding Jr., it became famous for the repeated demand for "show me the money." In business or politics, there is an old admonition, "follow the green." Business author Michael Leboeuf, in his book The Greatest Management Principle, says, "What gets rewarded gets done." The most powerful law in human nature, the foundation of the E factor, and the simplest explanation for almost every human behavior is the law of least resistance. This law explains why water flows downhill and through any hole or crevice. It also explains why people behave the way they do most of the time. The simplest explanation requiring the fewest number of steps to explain any human behavior is the desire of people to get what they want for as little as possible and, if at all possible, for nothing at all. People are what they are. They're lazy, greedy, selfish, ambitious, vain, ignorant, and impatient, constantly striving to fulfill their needs for safety, security, comfort, leisure, love, respect, and fulfillment by acquiring money and power. Therefore, the only way to create and maintain peace, harmony, and cooperation is to cut off all avenues to achievement except those of peaceful cooperation and healthy competition aimed at serving and satisfying other people in some way. This is the role of laws and enlightened public policy. Now, going back to childhood, children are completely expedient. They are like little animals, completely uninhibited and unafraid and striving to satisfy their appetites of the moment any way they possibly can, with little or no concern at all for the convenience or comfort of other people. If you want to raise a healthy, happy child, you have to teach him or her the connection between behavior and consequences, the link between engaging in peaceful, constructive behaviors and getting more of the things he or she really wants. You must be firm and fair and not allow him to get what he wants in any other way except by only doing those things that are best for him, both in the short term and in the long term. Children will always seek to get what they want the fastest and easiest way they possibly can. They will seek every possible way to achieve happiness and pleasure and avoid discomfort and disapproval. They will engage in positive or negative behaviors depending upon what works, depending upon the structure of incentives set up by their parents. Children begin to lie and tell half-truths at an early age, not because they're dishonest, but because they're expedient. If lying works to get them the C that they want and turns out to be the fastest and easiest way for them to satisfy their desires of the moment, they will lie more and more. The more they lie, the more they will rely upon lying as a tool for success, and the better they will become at lying. Today, our society is ensnared in a quagmire of lies, pouring out of almost every person and source. Politicians lie repeatedly, brazenly stating things that they know to be false for short-term political advantage. The news media lies continually, mainly by selectively reporting only those stories and quoting only those people whose statements are consistent with the viewpoint that they have already decided to express. Criminals lie, business people lie, lawyers lie, employees lie, husbands and wives lie. In many areas of daily life, it is automatically assumed that whatever the other person says initially is a lie or a half-truth. This propensity to lie starts in childhood, when children find that lying is the fastest and easiest way to get the things they want. As Alexander Pope wrote, "As the twig is bent, the tree's inclined." If the child learns at an early age that he can get what he wants if he does certain things in a particular way, the child will develop in the direction of repeating more and more of that behavior and getting better and better at it. If it is a good behavior, children will grow up with good character, capable and confident in themselves and their ability to succeed in life. If children are not carefully and consistently instructed in the importance of being honest and responsible, they will often grow up believing that the way to succeed is by doing as little as possible and by deceiving others whenever the opportunity. It has been said that adults are like children, but with better excuses. Whenever you meet an adult who has trouble staying on task at work or telling the truth, you invariably see the result of a childhood where he was encouraged or allowed to behave expediently to get the things he wanted. These habits of thought and action are often difficult to change later in life. In 1945, at the end of World War II, Friedrich von Hayek, later to be a Nobel Prize winner in economics, wrote a book entitled The Road to Serfdom. In this groundbreaking book, he explained how countries that increasingly relied on government to make and enforce economic and social decisions for the majority put that society on the road to serfdom. Perhaps the most important chapter in this book is called Why the Worst Get on Top. In this powerful analysis, Hayek demonstrated that in any system where violent, corrupt, or expedient behavior is rewarded, the most violent, corrupt, or expedient people will eventually rise to the top. They will use their intelligence, cunning, and ability to manipulate such a system to eventually step on, step over, and crush their competition in their lust for the money and power that accrues to the top people. This insight explained how Hitler, Mussolini, and Tojo rose to the top in Germany, Italy, and Japan. It explained how Stalin, the greatest mass murderer in human history, got to the top of the Soviet system, the most criminal and repressive system known to man. It explains how Mao Zedong and the violent men around him were able to take over the communist movement in China and dominate it for 50 years. This principle explains how Kim Song-il could dominate North Korea, repressing, starving, torturing, and murdering his own people year after year. It explains a crime boss or the head of a drug cartel. This principle, why the worst get on top, explains why it is that people like Saddam Hussein, another mass murderer, could run Iraq with incalculable brutality based on a sweeping national terror created by the threat of arbitrary arrest, torture, and murder year after year. This principle explains how the worst despots eventually work their way up the food chain to emerge at the top of the heap, and the actions that they will take to keep their money and power once they get there. Closer to home, this principle explains why violent and cunning men like Jimmy Hoffa could rise to the top of the Teamsters Union, allied with organized crime, continually engaging in bribery, corruption, and theft from union pension funds, and still stay on top year after year. The only way to build a society based on voluntary cooperation, freedom, liberty, and individual rights is to create a legal structure where people can only enrich themselves by serving others. Only when a free society or a free market is created, protected on all sides by legal restraints that block people from getting ahead in any other way but by serving others, is it possible to create a peaceful and prosperous society. It has been said that people who do not want to serve others choose rather to rule over them. There are always people in every society who do not like the idea of having to serve others. They do not like the idea of having their rewards tied to their contribution. They do not like the idea of having to earn the things they want and satisfy their needs by voluntarily cooperating with others and by depending upon the evaluations of others for their rewards. They don't like this at all. Instead, imagine that each person has a thievery gene that is part of their mental and emotional DNA. This thievery gene lurks just below the surface, ready to be activated when any opportunity to get something for nothing or little appears. This natural, knee-jerk, reflexive tendency has to be curbed continually, or it will spring forth in destructive, antisocial behaviors. If ever there is a way for expedient people to get the results they want faster and easier, and especially if it's something for nothing, they will find it and take it, like water running downhill, finding and flowing through any loophole or crevice that appears. If ever the structure of incentives allows corrupt or antisocial behavior, someone will find a way to take advantage of it. And the worst people will take the most advantage of it and eventually get on top. In business and in the free market, the only test for the validity of an idea or course of action is, does it work? The only way that you can tell whether or not a theory or principle is true is by testing it in the real world. Does it work? Does it bring about the results desired? Does it bring about better results than in any other system or theory? The good news is that in the material world, all results are measurable. In the business world, all results are measurable in financial terms. You can tell if something works in reality by simply looking at the numbers. If it is a good and worthwhile idea, it improves the quality of life and well-being of people in measurable terms. If it is not a good idea, it decreases the quality of life and well-being of people, again, in measurable terms. Throughout the world, whenever freedom and the free market have been introduced, especially into previously poor nations, they have achieved results that are often astonishing. Asia is one of the best examples. In 1945, both India and Japan were impoverished nations. Most of Japan had been bombed to rubble in World War II. India was just emerging from 300 years of British colonization. It was extremely poor and underdeveloped. Japan introduced the free market. The great monopolies were broken up, capital poured in, and the free market was encouraged to thrive. Within 3 decades, Japan became an ultra-modern industrial powerhouse, with its people enjoying some of the highest standards of living in the world. After World War II, India achieved its independence and immediately introduced a socialist system. Private enterprise and the free market were suffocated and replaced by corruption, political cronyism, and controls. As a result, for decades, India remained poor, corrupt, and backward, with hundreds of millions of its citizens existing on subsistence wages. The free market was soon introduced into Hong Kong, Singapore, Taiwan, and Korea. Once it caught on, the economies of these countries boomed. Their living standards rose dramatically. By 1995, the resource-poor island of Singapore surpassed England in annual income per person. Hong Kong became one of the most entrepreneurial and affluent places in the world. Taiwan boomed and flourished, achieving living standards 20 times greater than those of communist China across the straits. From 1950 to 2000, a period of 50 years, the average annual income in Korea went from $200 per year to $10,000 per year, an increase of 50 times. The soaring skyscrapers, beautiful hotels, superhighways, and vast industrial complexes of these countries are tributes to freedom, free markets, and free people. These are the kind of results that count. After World War II, following the example that Britain had set, New Zealand became an increasingly socialist country. The government interfered with or controlled almost every economic and social activity. Even though New Zealand was resource-rich and possessed of a well-educated population, the country stagnated decade after decade. Moving continually in the wrong direction, the government placed layer after layer of regulations, controls, and taxes on every part of the New Zealand economy. Unemployment soared. Welfare rolls became unsustainable. Businesses stagnated, and young people moved away year after year seeking opportunities in other lands. Then, in the 1980s, a Labour government under Prime Minister David Lang came to power in New Zealand. For the first time in New Zealand history, the newly elected politicians sat down around the table and looked at each other and agreed, "This isn't working." Thus began one of the most profound changes in modern economic history. The Minister of Finance, Roger Douglas, set off on a fact-finding tour of the United States and Britain, looking for ways to turn the New Zealand economy around. In the United States, he was introduced to Reaganomics, the belief that by cutting taxes, slashing regulations, and encouraging the free market, economic activity could be stimulated and prosperity could be created. He went on to England, where he learned about Thatcherism, the idea of getting the government out of most economic activities, curbing the out-of-control power of the labor unions, and encouraging entrepreneurship. Armed with these ideas, Roger Douglas returned to New Zealand, laid out a new economic plan to install the best ideas of both Reagan and Thatcher, and, with the full backing of his government, began the transformation of the New Zealand economy. Within 4 years, the economy had turned around completely. Unemployment had dropped and the welfare rolls were cut in half. The government sold off and got out of most companies, corporations, and organizations that it controlled. Exports took off. Entrepreneurs started new businesses. Living standards went up and prosperity blossomed everywhere. 4 years after Roger Douglas returned from his trip, they had fondly dubbed his policies Rogernomics, and New Zealand was ranked as the fastest-growing industrial country in the world. The free market had worked its magic once again. John Stuart Mill, the British philosopher, once wrote, "The only thing necessary for the triumph of evil is for good men to do nothing." The forces of compulsion and coercion, the something-for-nothing people, are always waiting and watching for an opportunity to get back in, no matter how prosperous people become with freedom and free markets. The thievery gene, activated by the E factor and the desire to get something for nothing, infects countless people at a deep level. Like a cancer that has gone into remission, always capable of being reactivated and spreading throughout the body. In Chapter 1, we discuss the fact that emotions distort valuations. There are two negative emotions that are used to justify and rationalize the worst qualities of human nature: envy and greed. Like the thievery gene, the emotions of envy and greed lurk just under the surface in the minds and hearts of many people. In combination, they generate resentment toward anyone who is more successful in almost any area. Shakespeare once wrote, "A touch of nature makes the whole world kin." He said that envy of the successes and accomplishments of others lurks just below the surface in almost every person. It can easily be triggered by an appeal to our sense of vanity. People prefer to believe that the reason that someone else is more successful than they are has nothing to do with their own talents, abilities, attitudes, actions, or behaviors. They prefer to believe that people are successful not because they have worked long and hard to achieve it, but because they have simply been lucky. Democratic Congressman Richard Gephardt said a couple of years ago, "Those who have been successful at the gaming tables of life must be forced to share their winnings with those who have not done as well." In his view, material success, usually attained after many years of hard work, was the equivalent of casino gambling. This is the kind of thinking that dominates much of the policy making in Washington and in the individual states. Each person has a deep need to rationalize away his own perceived failures and deficiencies. The easiest way to do this is to blame someone else for your problems. Politicians, eager to get votes by appealing to the lowest common denominator of human nature, will eagerly step forward to encourage people to believe that the reason that they are not doing well is because others are doing better. Of course, this is the same as saying that the reason that you are sick is because someone else is healthy. The reason you are doing poorly is because someone else is doing well. The reason that you are unfit or overweight is because others are fit and trim. The argument is absurd, but reason and rationality have no place when it comes to emotions such as envy and greed, especially when they're combined with resentment. Envy is perhaps the worst of the negative emotions. Envy hurts and often destroys the possessor of the emotion, but it has no offsetting benefits or pleasures. If you engage in the cardinal sins of gluttony or lust, at least you get some pleasure or satisfaction in the short term. But with envy, you only feel angry, hostile, resentful, and often depressed and worthless. There's no payoff, and it doesn't even hurt or affect the person or persons it is aimed at. It only hurts the possessor. The emotions of envy and greed, combined with resentment, always requires there to be an enemy. Someone must be to blame. If someone is to blame, someone must be punished. That person must be taxed, regulated, or even prosecuted. The more the envious person thinks about how evil this blameworthy person is, the angrier he becomes, and the more justified he feels in demanding that this person be made to suffer in some way. In a free society where people are paid based on their willingness and ability to serve others, the enemy is always the rich. These people are loosely defined as anyone who is doing better than the average. Almost all economic and social policy in America and throughout Europe is based on envy and resentment of the successful, and is motivated by a desire to punish them in some way. A healthy, normal person sees himself as responsible for his own life. He does not blame his problems or his life situation on anyone but himself. He never complains, criticizes others who are more successful, or condemns people for doing well. If he is not happy with his situation, he gets busy and takes action to improve it. He doesn't blame other people for his own personal problems. Weak people, on the other hand, people who lack the character that only comes from serious thinking and the practice of self-mastery and self-discipline, are easily convinced that their problems and deficiencies are caused by others. This frees them from any responsibility to do anything for themselves. Envy, resentment, and blaming others turn the possessor of these emotions into a victim. The perception of victimhood makes him feel weak and inadequate, helpless and hopeless. It makes him simultaneously angry and discouraged, and capable of being easily manipulated into supporting any politician or activist who promises to punish the imagined cause of his own personal problems with taxes and regulations. This always turns out to be the rich. No one ever envies a failure or lobbies to punish failures with taxes and regulations. Instead of doing something to improve his situation, the victim, driven by the E factor, motivated by the desire to get something for nothing, supports anyone who promises to get him free money with no effort on his part. You know, almost anyone can catch a cold if he allows himself to become overtired and susceptible to it. In the same way, almost anyone can catch the something-for-nothing virus if he is not continually on guard. We are all susceptible. Once SFN strikes, it can quickly corrupt all your mental and emotional programs. We are surrounded by people who will tell us repeatedly that we are entitled to free money at the expense of others. Even though this is impossible in the long run, it is a fantasy that too many people want to believe. To immunize yourself against the temptations of the negative emotions of envy, resentment, greed, and the desire to get something for nothing, I have prepared a pledge for each person to read and sign. Here it is. It's called the Responsibility Pledge, and it goes like this. I accept complete responsibility for myself, my life, my family, my financial situation, and everything that happens to me. I am a completely free, proud, self-reliant individual. I look to myself for the answers to my questions and the solutions to my problems. I am a complete optimist. I look for the good in every situation. I seek the valuable lesson in every setback or obstacle. I think about my goals and how I can achieve them most of the time. I focus on the solution rather than on the problem. I am not a victim. I refuse to complain, condemn, or criticize. If I am not happy with a situation, I take action to change it. I blame no one else for any aspect of my life. I recognize that there is a fair and full price that must be paid for anything worthwhile. I do not try to get something for nothing. I refuse to accept something for nothing, and I do not support any person, process, or policy that attempts to give me or anyone else anything to which I or they are not justly entitled to as the result of personal hard work and sacrifice. I am a successful, happy person. I am grateful for my life and my opportunities. I believe that everything in the universe is conspiring to make me happier, healthier, and more prosperous. I have an attitude of gratitude toward everyone and everything. And each person is invited to sign this pledge and live by it, which, of course, would change the world almost overnight. How do you feel as you listen to this pledge? Are you hesitant or eager to sign your name at the bottom? How you think and feel when you hear this pledge to yourself will tell you a lot about your philosophy of life. How others react and respond when you show this pledge to them will tell you a lot about how they think and feel as well. In the next chapter, you will learn how you can get the E factor and the universal desire to get something for nothing under control. Chapter 4. Character reigns supreme. As Thomas Jefferson said, honesty is the first chapter of the Book of Wisdom. The fundamental glue that holds our society together is the quality of character. It is the foundation of happy families, companies, and organizations. Character assures survival, civility, and the blessings of peaceful cooperation. Your character is the crystallization of your true values and beliefs, your innermost convictions. It is the summary of the qualities and virtues by which you live. As Ralph Waldo Emerson said in regard to character, "What you are shouts at me so loudly that I can't hear a word you say." The aim of virtually all religions is to establish and encourage people to develop higher levels of character. A major focus of philosophy throughout the ages has been to identify the qualities of character that are most conducive to success in personal and public life. Dr. David McClelland of Harvard, in his book, The Achieving Society, wrote that the direction of a society is largely determined by the qualities of character that are most admired in that society. As Shakespeare wrote, "He who steals my purse steals trash, but he who steals my good name steals all." Character is everything. Everything you do in life involves a choice, a decision on your part. Because you have so many options, you are constantly choosing among alternatives, between what you value more and what you value less. You can only do one thing or choose one thing at a time. When you are under pressure and forced to choose, you reveal your true self, your real values, and your genuine inner convictions. When you choose, you tell yourself and others what is most important to you. Your actions always tell yourself and others what you truly value the most at that moment. It is not what you say or wish or hope or intend that reveals your character. It is only what you do at the moment of choosing, and especially when you have to choose between what is right and what is expedient. The only way that people can be held back from acting expediently in ways that are harmful to themselves and others is by means of internal or external constraints. An internal constraint exists when you decide by and for yourself to do what is right no matter what the temptation. An external constraint is something that is imposed upon you by law and society or by circumstances that forces you to do the right thing or to behave in a certain way, whether you want to or not. The best restraint you can put on the E factor in yourself is internal, chosen by yourself rather than external, imposed upon you by someone or something else. As Herodotus wrote, "Only when a man's battle begins with himself is he really worth anything." There is a hierarchy of social class in every country. In every society, some people are more highly developed and more worthy of respect and esteem than others. Where we rank in comparison with others is an essential part of our self-image and self-respect. We all need to know the relative hierarchical order of people around us. We need to know who is above us and who is below us, socially and economically. The primary hierarchy in advanced societies is that of character. The greater the qualities of character that one has, the better a person he is, and the more esteemed and respected he is by most of the people around him. Character development is therefore a lifelong process and a never-ending goal. The core quality of character is integrity. This can be measured by how absolutely honest one is with himself and others. The depth of your integrity largely determines the strength of your commitment to each of your other values. Character can therefore be best defined and measured as the degree to which a person adheres to higher values. A person of great character is one who would never compromise his or her sacred honor under any circumstances. In other words, a person with character would never act expediently in such a way that it would harm others, no matter what the temptation. He would always do the right thing in any situation. Strength of character can be measured on a scale from 1 to 10, from lowest to highest. In addition, each separate quality or virtue can be organized on a scale of intensity from 1 to 10. Everyone possesses almost every virtue or quality to some degree. Even the most dishonest and disreputable person will demonstrate a certain amount of integrity in dealing with certain other people. That's why it is often said that there is honor among thieves. How high a person ranks on a scale of 1 to 10 in any particular virtue, and in the measure of character overall, is determined by the percentage of the time that that person practices that quality throughout his or her daily life. Some people have high, unshakable levels of character which they would never compromise. They would rather suffer or even die than to break their word or go against their deepest values. Others have varying degrees of character, depending upon the circumstances and the temptations of the moment. They have the modern curse of situational ethics. They are expedient when it comes to character. At the bottom of the scale, there are those who have no character at all. There are no principles or values that they would not compromise if the expected reward was attractive enough. These are the kind of people who become habitual criminals. When people with no character, no internal constraints, get into positions of power or authority, their effect on others can be devastating. The E factor drives everyone to be lazy, greedy, ambitious, selfish, vain, ignorant, and impatient. But to people lower down on the character scale, expedient behavior is almost irresistible. Because of their backgrounds, because they are weak in character, they cannot stop themselves from impulsively and reflexively acting expediently. They cannot resist the striving to get something for nothing at the slightest temptation or the first opportunity. You see this character weakness most commonly in criminal behavior. Habitual criminals cannot not steal. They have convinced themselves over time that the very best, fastest, and easiest way to get the things they want is to take them from others. They don't consider any other options. You see this weakness of character in people who have addictions to food, drugs, alcohol, and tobacco. They are not strong enough to stop themselves from indulging in the immediate sensory pleasures of these substances. Now, no one starts off with an addiction, but by giving in to the E factor over and over, they finally reach the point where they are incapable of stopping themselves from ingesting substances that are harmful to them. Worst of all, you see this weakness of character amongst people who are too weak to resist the blandishments of various forms of welfare, entitlements, and free money from the government or any other source. They cannot stop themselves, and no amount is ever enough. One of the most important principles in understanding human behavior is the law of incremental commitment. This law says that people do not leap from self-sufficiency and independence into the trap of welfare and dependence on government in one step. They do not go from being law-abiding members of society to habitual criminals in one act. This evolution takes place gradually over time. Like an alcoholic who starts off with one drink after work in the evening, the individual who becomes addicted to free money from the government starts off by taking a single payment at a time when he is particularly vulnerable or broke. Just as one drink leads to another for an alcoholic, one welfare payment or handout leads to the next for a person who gradually becomes dependent on government. Soon, he becomes addicted and unable to resist the next handout. It's the same with criminals. They start off stealing small amounts and then larger and larger amounts, especially if they get away with it at the beginning. I'll dedicate a whole chapter to this later. Most people know that there is something inherently wrong with taking free money, with living off the government, with being dependent and making no contribution to the society in which they live. To compensate for this deep inner feeling of unease, people who are getting something for nothing create elaborate justifications and rationales to explain to themselves and to others why they are entitled to this free money. Every rationale or excuse comes back to the same explanation. They see themselves as victims who are entitled to free money as compensation for something they feel society has done to them or not done for them. Simultaneously, they see the people who supply free money as being guilty for some reason and therefore justly required to provide the free money to the victim. Welfare workers are often surprised when welfare recipients tell them that not only are they entitled to welfare payments, but people who do not take welfare are actually suckers. Many welfare recipients have actually convinced themselves that they are superior to people who work for a living and pay the taxes they live off. The foundation quality of character is self-discipline. Self-discipline is manifested in several ways, in self-control, self-mastery, and self-restraint. The writer Albert Hubbard once said, "Self-discipline is the ability to make yourself do what you should do, when you should do it, whether you feel like it or not." This is a good definition of character to work from. On a scale of 1 to 10, men and women of admirable character have high degrees of self-discipline. Men and women with weaker characters have little or no self-discipline at all. They are basically out of control. They cannot constrain or restrain themselves. Every minute, every hour, and every day, the battle rages back and forth between the forces of the E factor and the power of self-discipline. The mental and emotional contest goes on between doing what is fun, easy, and expedient, on the one hand, and doing what is hard, necessary, and right, on the other. Whichever of these two contesting influences wins in the heart and mind of the individual determines the happiness, success, and status of that person, both in the moment and throughout his life.
To continue, please insert the next CD.